morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Well, this is a big day, ladies and gentlemen. The first Wednesday of the month, and today's the last day of the Wednesday of the month, we're doing our animal show, and we're doing it at a different time because our beloved veterinarian, Darren Llewellyn, KSFR's own veterinarian, is moving away. How could you do that to us?
Well, I love Santa Fe, and I've loved living here, and the people that I've met and the animals that I've got to work with have just been wonderful. But for my family, we're looking at having to move home for the best of our family, especially for my girls. We want to get them back close to their grandparents, and unfortunately, it's not in Santa Fe. And eventually, I may be back once the kids are grown and out of the nest. Maybe return and.
So another 17 and a half years.
Exactly.
From now.
And if Mary Charlotte's still on the air in 17 years, I'll be back, Santa Fe.
Ladies and gentlemen. And of course, Bill Hutchison from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society is with us today.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Well, the whole question of grief and loss comes up not only with the fact that Darren Llewellyn is moving to Texas, which we are grieving and losing in great measure. But the question of what happens when you lose a pet is something that I realized that we'd never talked about on the air in the 3 years that we've been doing this show.
Yeah.
I just lost my little dachshund, Dugan, a few weeks ago, and it was quite a process. The grief that's involved in losing a pet, it's greater than a lot of non-animal people can possibly imagine.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's just like losing a family member. Pets are our family members, and you know, losing a pet can often feel like losing a child, and the process that you have to go through afterwards to kind of cope with the that loss can be quite difficult.
There's a way, I think, in which animals become, I was just thinking about this as Darren was talking, that animals become a part of us in a way that other people don't always. Because when we're with our animals, they're close by a lot more often physically than people we live with. They're right next to us often.
Especially when they put their heads on your pillowcase every night.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's exactly what I'm thinking. I'm thinking of my little pug dog who sleeps right next to me, and my Great Dane who sleeps at the foot of the bed. And when you lose an animal, a companion animal that's been with you for a long time, it really is like losing a part of yourself, an extension of your psyche. I mean, certainly they're their own creatures, but they become so tuned into us, I think, and it is a lot like losing a deep part of yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, not just losing a pet, you know, when we say losing a pet, you know, it could be anything from a pet getting lost, which I had to deal with this year, to a pet dying from a disease or injury, to humane euthanasia. And I wanted to speak a little bit about that because I know there are many differing opinions as far as how you feel about euthanasia. I personally feel that humane euthanasia really oftentimes is the last best gift we can give our friends, especially in the cases of animals that have chronic debilitating terminal illnesses. And we are blessed to have an option to not let them suffer. You know, it sounds like something Jack Kevorkian might say, but I really think that you know, humane euthanasia in certain cases, when the future of the animal is relatively hopeless, and they're going to have to go through a process of tremendous pain and illness, and especially in some chronic debilitating diseases, you just see their pet wither and waste away to nothing. And really, their quality of life at that point is just so poor that, you know, it almost seems like we kind of keep them around more for our sakes than for their sakes. And a lot of times pets will let you know, I'm ready to go. I don't want to go through this anymore.
Well, how do they let you know that?
Well, you know, a lot of times they make their... make their peace, really, you know, and it's hard really to kind of see that change because it's a gradual change. It's not like they wake up one day and said, okay, I'm done with it. Take me to the vet. I want to be put to sleep. But you kind of see how their quality of life diminishes. They don't enjoy the things that they used to. They don't want to eat like they did. They may just rather go hide in a closet or under a bed somewhere rather than interact with you, just because they feel so bad. And at that point, you know, really, it takes a very strong person to realize what's going on and to make that decision that, you know, gosh, Fluffy's quality of life is so poor now. Am I keeping her here for my sake, or am I keeping her here for Fluffy's sake? And oftentimes, you know, Fluffy will let you know that I'm ready, and I'm not enjoying my life anymore. And oftentimes at that point, you know, I do recommend, you know, that euthanasia is an option. Now, I also understand that there are many people out there that don't believe in humane euthanasia. They would rather let their pets die of natural causes. That seems to be what's the case. You know, they kind of translate what goes on in the human world to their pets. And really, as a veterinarian, I'm an advocate for humane euthanasia, as, like I said before, being the last best gift that we could give these guys so that they don't suffer and that they don't have to wither away to nothing.
I think
with the animals, they don't. This is anecdotal. This is just what I've witnessed. What I think I've witnessed over the years at the shelter, that we can understand suffering. We can suffer, but also take our suffering and say, "I'm sick with this disease." You can sort of get your head around your suffering. And cats and dogs, animals for the most part, I think, do not understand why they're suffering. They just experience it as straight-up suffering. It's a way of being. The same way that I think a dog is not aware of being a dog, it just inhabits its dogness. They're not aware of the fact that they're suffering so much as they are just suffering. And it can be tempting, I think, with the advances in veterinary medicine. We can keep the body going. But they have a mind and they have a heart, and those things, we can't really touch those things. And once they slip to a point where the place they're in is a place of suffering, then I tend to agree that we do have a responsibility, and it becomes a very, as you say, a very difficult choice, a very difficult choice. But that's a thing that we can do for them that we can't, for a variety of reasons, do for one another.
I think there's another dimension to this, which is to really question whether a domestic pet can die of natural causes the way an animal in nature dies of natural causes. A little dog like the one I had, who was so old, he would have been prey if he'd been allowed to run around in nature a long time ago. And so, in a way, the life that they have in our houses at the end of their lives isn't really natural.
Right. And you know, to be quite honest, I mean, any pet's life from birth to death isn't quite a natural life.
Yeah,
I mean,
these
are not wild animals. These are animals that have been domesticated for thousands of years, and it's our responsibility to be their stewards. And Bill's absolutely right. We, as a veterinarian, we can keep the body going. With modern medicine and different techniques, surgical techniques, and the advances of pharmaceuticals to help with certain conditions, we can keep them going a lot of times, even after their spirit is broken. But it's once that spirit is broken, that's when we really need to sit back and just kind of take a look at things and see, am I going to keep the body going for my sake, you know? And a lot of times I'll recommend and say, I know you're not ready to put your dog or cat to sleep. We can keep him around for a while, but I do want you to think about this because this is a terminal, chronic, debilitating disease that your animal may have. And you have to really kind of step back and say, gosh, am I ready for this, first of all? And second is, how am I going to deal with this afterwards? You know, I think that's the biggest point with especially with euthanasia, is that many people, you know, don't want to go through that grieving process. They're not ready to go through that grieving process. And so it may take some time while the animal is of course, being treated for the disease or injury that they have to kind of cope with what's going to happen, you know?
Now, do you as a veterinarian see cases where an animal really should be put down or allowed to die, where the owners just keep it alive for far too long?
Absolutely. And, you know, there are various numbers of things, from, you know, in cats that have chronic renal failure to dogs that have cancer. You know, there are things that we can do, especially in with cancer. The advances in oncology have really, you know, kept these guys going for, you know, especially over the last 10 years. We're using radiation, we're using chemotherapy, we're using all the modern medical techniques they would use on a human being.
The same things they use on humans.
Exactly.
The same chemistry.
Exactly. And, you know, and a lot of times I tell them, you know, this is something that that can be done. It's relatively expensive, of course, but we can try to get your animal into remission. Now, there are certain types of cancers that once I make a diagnosis, oftentimes, you know, my first recommendation is euthanasia. For example, bone cancer in dogs. It is an extremely, extremely painful thing to go through for dogs because basically the tumor is eating away their bone. And I tell them, said, you know, oftentimes once we diagnose that, if you want to try to prolong their life as best you can, we're talking about having to amputate limbs. Now, I'm sure everyone has seen a three-legged dog before, and they do wonderfully. But with this particular type of cancer, you know, even with an amputation, within a year it has spread somewhere else. And usually it goes to the lungs. And once we find that it's there, you know, the chances of recovery are none, basically. And I always recommend, you know, it is time, you know, because this is going to get worse. Your dog is going to suffer. Now, a lot of people can't deal with the fact that, oh, gosh, I don't want to amputate the limb. Can't we just give some pain medication to the dog? And we all do that for a short period of time until eventually, you know, especially with bone cancer, that the bones become so brittle that they fracture and break. And then it's, you know, they're so terribly painful. All the narcotics in the world are not going to really improve this dog's quality of life. And so really that with certain diseases, sometimes I always recommend euthanasia first because what they're going to go through because of what they have is just, it's almost cruel, you know, to let them suffer and let them be in pain like that. And basically we're just keeping them here for our sakes, rather than for their sakes, because really, I know if I had some kind of untreatable, extremely painful disease, I would, you know, and I can relate this to my grandmother who recently passed. She had pancreatic cancer, and, it was very painful for her, and really the last month and a half of her life, she was in hospice and was on so much morphine that you know, she wasn't herself anymore. And my father and I had a really heated debate about, you know, should we be able to do humane euthanasia in people? Especially because my grandmother told me, said, Darren, I'm ready to go. I've made my peace. I don't want to be in pain anymore. I just want to die. And then that lingered on for a couple more months afterwards. As a human being and being a steward of a companion animal, you know, we have the luxury, and I wouldn't call it a luxury, but we have the option to, you know, to make sure that they don't suffer and make sure that they're not in pain. And it's often, you know, it's an extremely difficult decision to make. But a lot of times if you just take yourself out of the situation and empathize with the pet and see, you know, see how you think you would feel if you were having to be, you know, all of these pills being shoved down your throat and fluids being given and having to stay in the hospital 2 or 3 days out of every month, what would you want to be done? And a lot of times if I explain that to the owners, they go, gosh, you know, I can see what you're saying now. And then oftentimes, you know, we'll do the, you know, we'll euthanize because of it. So
I think there's, in a way, it's a hard decision. And sometimes, having put a few pets down over the years, sometimes it's an easy decision. Mm-hmm. My house seems to be a place where people bring their geriatric pets. And so I ended up with my friend's beautiful standard poodle some years ago. And he got more and more debilitated over a period of a few months, but we just knew it wasn't his time to go yet. And even though he could barely walk, and I would have to take him outside and hold him up while he did his business, and I mean it was a messy couple of weeks there, but it still wasn't his time. And then he got to where he couldn't breathe, and it was his time. And we brought him in, and it was a very sad but also very peaceful death, mm-hmm. because the dog had lived his life cycle. He was no longer functioning in any way, and it was his time to go. And I think there's this moment where people can realize that time has come, or that time hasn't come quite yet.
It's interesting. I was to harken back to something Darren was saying a second ago. I think I've noticed that a lot of people who work in the veterinary community or in animal welfare, the subject of human euthanasia and assisted suicide, et cetera, comes up a lot. And what's really interesting about that is I think it's because we are in a unique position to really see the difference between a lot of suffering and no suffering, or very little suffering. And it brings up the question very much, just like Darren's saying, as he might present it to the owner, what would I want in this situation? And when you've seen a lot of animals come in who are either have chronic illness or tremendous injury from being hit by a car or whatever it is, and you see the endless capacity for suffering in an animal, really, really endless, up to the point where they're no longer alive, they can suffer tremendously, then obviously it begs the question for yourself, and it really seems to clarify, I think, in a lot of people, and certainly not everyone in the animal community, but for a lot of people, that humane euthanasia in these situations it's a gift, it's an absolute gift, and I can only hope for myself, you know, that if I'm ever in a position where I'm suffering and toward the end of my life and there's not a lot of hope of recovery, that I could make the same compassionate choices for myself that we have the ability and responsibility, I think, to take for our animals. And I really understand what a hotly debatable issue it is, and that there are a lot of people out there who just can't get on this train, but I just feel so strongly that if you see a lot of suffering in animals and you see it's almost impossible to describe, because humans, I don't think, can suffer in quite the same way that animals can. If it was a superpower, it would be an amazing superpower, but it's like it's a horrible curse in some ways. I don't know. That's not even exactly what I want to say. But they can suffer just unbelievable amounts. And so this whole issue of humane euthanasia, it really should be called compassionate euthanasia, because it becomes a gift at a certain point. It becomes a gift, and I have seen so many times the absolute relief in an animal's eyes as you administer the injection, just those few seconds before life ends, where there's no suffering. The pain is stopping. They are departing the body, and I've seen it enough times to absolutely believe with 100% of myself that it is a release and a relief for them that we can give them.
It's coming up to 8:30 on KSFR, and we're going to take a little break right now to hear from some of our beloved underwriters. We'll be back in a moment with Bill Hutchison from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society and veterinarian Darren Llewellyn. Stay tuned to KSFR. Okay. And we are back. By the way, before we get started again, I wanted to remind people that tonight Jeremy Scahill will be at the Lensic. He is the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. It's at 7 o'clock at the Lensic tonight, and that's a benefit for KSFR. Scahill will be introduced by former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. For ticket information, you can call the Lensic box office, 988-1234. I will be there as well for the question and answer. And Jeremy Scahill is an incredible, one of those rare breeds in the United States, investigative reporter. So, ladies and gentlemen, We're back with Darren Llewellyn and Bill Hutchison. And we've talked a lot, wonderful breakfast conversation, ladies and gentlemen, about the death of our pets. But then there is this whole process of grieving that one goes through after the little dog or cat or animal, whatever your animal is. I think it's probably strongest with dogs and cats as opposed to hamsters and iguanas, although I could be wrong about that.
Tell that to a seven-year-old who's lost its hamster.
Yeah, you'd be surprised, absolutely.
Well, I lost, my dog ate my hamster when I was a little kid. And I found the little hamster carcass on the landing of the stairs. But
I don't think that's an uncommon first experience with death of a pet for a kid.
Yeah, and I cried about it for maybe a little while, and then we buried it in a Kleenex box in the yard. And, that hamster didn't love me. I mean, that was the honest truth about that hamster, whereas my little dog Dugan really did. I mean, we had a bond of mutual love. And it was huge. And I found that the experience of grief was so huge. But there were some things that really helped me get past it. And one of the things that happened was I wrote an email to all of my friends who either knew the dog or knew my relationship with the dog. Basically, anybody who I thought would be sympathetic at all, I wrote an email to, which was lots of people. And I got back tons of incredibly kind, sympathetic emails from my friends, and every single one that came, I bawled again, and after a few days, I was done. And the combination of the fact that the dog really had lived out his life and died a peaceful death in the hands of some of our wonderful friends at Smith Veterinary Hospital, who were extremely kind, and they were bawling themselves, even the veterinarians. The combination between the fact that he died a peaceful death and there was so much sympathy, after a while, it's when you observe yourself, grief is a process that does have an end. And you still miss the dog, but you're no longer grieving about it. And it's not, I found it not to be, I mean, having lost my father at the age of 18, that grief almost never goes away. And it goes away, but it's not even comparable to the loss of a pet.
Yeah. And, you know, really, and Mary Charlotte's absolutely right. When we deal with loss, kind words from friends can help. And what I also find is just talking about the good times, remembering those funny little anecdotal stories about that particular pet, and just kind of remembering can help you deal with that loss. And so that can help quite a bit. Some folks feel that they need to find a replacement for that pet almost instantaneously, you know.
It seems like a natural instinct.
Yeah, and
there's a gigantic hole in your life.
Yeah, exactly. There's a big void left with
especially
with
if you don't have
loss.
Other pets.
Exactly. And so some people find that it's easiest for them to deal with that loss by replacing that particular pet. Now, of course, you're never going to find a replacement for, you know, those little quirky things that Dugan did or that your pet may do.
Like sneezing honkers all over your house.
the big boogers coming from his nose, exactly. It does help some people because that void that's left, they need something to fill it. And so that's one thing that can help with some folks. Now, some other people just can't even fathom the idea of replacing a pet almost instantaneously. Eventually, they may get another pet, but they have to go through the whole grieving process first and deal with their loss before they can actually kind of open their homes and open their hearts to a new companion. And so, dealing with that process can be different for these people. Talking about their particular pets or memorializing their pets. And there's lots and lots of ways to do that. There's a wonderful, here in Santa Fe, there's a wonderful pet memorial out on Bishop's Lodge Road. And if you've never seen it, I do suggest, you know, just go out there and take a look. It's a really peaceful setting, almost garden-esque, with a nice statue of St. Francis. And tiles that that can be purchased with your pet's name and their, you know, dates of birth and death on there. It's not a cemetery per se, but
you don't bury your pets there.
No,
or scatter their ashes.
You can scatter their ashes if you'd like, but they don't. I don't think they allow burial there. But with the tiles, it's something that you know, you can go and sit there in a peaceful setting and just remember the good times, and that can help you deal with loss.
I think also having a dinner party or just a picnic or something with your friends,
yeah,
who knew the dog and
awake.
Talk about him.
Awake, exactly. It's just like how we deal with losing a someone in our lives, a human being in our lives. We have a ceremony to remember them. Now, granted, it could be extremely sad and it can be extremely joyful, too. Just kind of basically remembering those good things and bad things about the pet that had been, you know, that passed on. Another option, too, and, a lot of folks don't realize that they could do this, but sometimes setting up a memorial fund for your pet through your veterinarian's hospital, through the veterinary hospital, can help. You know, if you set up a fund, and we have a couple of kind benefactors at Smith Veterinary that have set up a fund, you know, for their pets even before they have passed on. But they know that that time is coming soon, and so they've set up a memorial fund to help other animals in need when the owners may not have the funds to take care of their medical care.
Well, somebody gave a very kind contribution to the Santa Fe Animal Shelter Spay Neuter Fund in the name of Dugan after he passed on,
yes.
And that was a little memorial for him as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there are a lot of things that you can do to kind of help you to remember and help you to kind of go through that grieving process. And the grieving process is not the same for every pet owner. The spectrum is very wide as far as how people deal with grief. And it's a very personal thing, too. You know, it's hard for me to say, you know, oh, just get over it. You know, this is the way most people do it. It's different for every person, and you know, you have to find what's going to be best for you to help deal with that loss, because it is quite a significant loss, and having to go through that grieving process is a very natural thing, and it's, you know, like I said, different for every person.
I think that sometimes as somebody who has 2 10-year-old dogs, and one of them is a Great Dane Greyhound mix, so 10 is getting pretty old for her. I think one of the things that we can do is start, not necessarily preparing for the loss of the pet, but preparing yourself for the reality of what will come down the road, and do things to ameliorate, to deal with the grief. As my dog Chloe has gotten older and I've seen the gray crawl across her muzzle faster and faster every year, I've started taking a lot more pictures of her doing the things that she likes to do. And I know that when the time comes, I'll be able to look back on those pictures of her being in her element and being the dog that she is, and feel really fondly about that. I also try to spend a lot more time with her just one-on-one. I have 2 dogs and a cat, and so giving that special time to them, certainly all throughout their lives. But I, like many people, get busy and don't think about the importance of this one-on-one time necessarily, until I see that it takes her a little longer to get up in the morning, that she's a lot grayer than she used to be, that I haven't seen her run at full bolt for a couple of years. These are things that make me realize, excuse me, that I will lose this fantastic dog one day, and I want to do everything in my power to build a lot of those memories. Just remembering them when they're gone is really important, but building fabulous memories with them when you know that there will be a time that they're no longer with you is really, it's really important. And I feel a lot better about the prospect of her going, because you know, through much of my years of youthful folly, she was an unwitting participant and victim. And
are those now, years over?
They're coming to a gradual crawl instead of a full tilt run. But she's been through a lot with me over the years, and I want I really want to remember her, and I want to honor her while she's alive in a way that helps me honor her when she's gone.
And those are simple things. I mean, it's not, you don't have to go out of your way that much. Making sure they get their walks every day is a way of honoring them when they're alive. Dugan, of my three dogs, he was the only one that you could really call a good dog.
I've never had one of those, I've got to be honest with you.
He was a really good dog, and I love Milk and Honey, but they're a little more difficult, being the Jack Russell Terriers that they are. But Dugan, this old dachshund mix, he could go to poetry readings. He could go to the video library. The last errand I did with him was to the travel store downtown, and I took him on the leash, and then when I was in there, let him off the leash, and they were very pleased with him, and a teenage girl at the Zia Diner just stood up, ran across the patio and said, "Oh, how cute." And he was a dog who got to do the things that he wanted to do in his old age, and that also makes the loss process a lot easier. You don't have regrets. And I think that's as true with animals as it is with people.
One of the things that I've long admired some of our adoption counselors for at the shelter is the ability to help people through this process, because we get people from time to time who come in having very recently lost an animal. And our adoption counselors are very careful with folks who have just been in the, or who are in the grieving process, to really help them decide for themselves whether this is a way to, whether they're really interested in bringing a new animal into the home, or they're trying to do anything to stop this profound hurt that this absence has caused them. And it's very delicate, because when we're in these situations, we don't even necessarily understand our feelings ourselves. And I think talking to people, talking a lot to people about the animals that you had, really helps you understand the depth of that relationship, and certainly helps you pace yourself when you're ready to bring a new animal into the home, because they have to be who they are. They can't be Dugan number two.
Yeah, exactly. Now, a thing that I think is very important to talk about also is, if you have children, the children are close to the animal, a child, you know, age 4, age 6, age 10, 12, a teenager. To what extent, and this is maybe, well, it's a question for both of you, is it important to bring children through the whole death and dying process, and then how do you deal with their grieving process?
I'm glad you said something about that, Mary Charlotte, because, you know, I have to deal with this quite a bit. Families, where the family companion is ill and it's time for him either to pass naturally or by euthanasia. I get this question a lot. Is it, how am I going to let the kids know what happened? How are they going to deal with this? I can tell you personally, as a child, really, and I think this probably goes for most people as a child, their first experience of death is usually the death of a pet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some people ask me, well, should I just tell them that, you know, Sparky had to go away for a while or something like that? And I always tell them, you know, kids are not dumb, okay? Kids need to be a part of the process. They need to know, you know, Sparky is very ill, and we have the choice to let Sparky die either naturally, or we can set it up ourselves with euthanasia. And make it a peaceful process. And I think involving the children in the process will help them to develop a more firm understanding of the death process. You know, death is just as much part of life as being born. And children, you know, believe it or not, even at early ages, 2, 3, 4, they kind of get it, you know?
I think it can help you create a more compassionate child as well.
Absolutely.
When they can understand the incredible emotional complexities of how you feel about the animal versus how the animal feels being in its body and in the world right now. I think I've seen kids in the shelter go through some incredibly complex processes to come to some incredibly enlightened decisions, and they can do it. They really can do it.
They telling have the capacity, the absolutely.
What are some of the techniques that, I mean, some of the tools that children can use after the pet is gone to, I mean, do they do artworks?
That's one of the things that I've seen most often is parents encouraging their kids to color lots and lots of pictures of the animal. Mm-hmm. And that definitely walks a kid through the process of sorrow and of remembering.
Mm-hmm. And really, I feel that even telling your pet, or I'm sorry, telling your child that, you know, like Bill said earlier before we were on the show, it's like I've had people say that, oh, well, you know, Fluffy's, you know, had to go away and he's with Jesus now. You know, and that of course, is for
that's an abstract thing for a child to understand sometimes.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, really, I think that including them in the process, and even having them present when the pet is euthanized, if that's what their decision was, is very important for that child to get through that process. Because, you know, I've had people said, well, we kind of had to lie to our kid about this. I told them, you know, this may come back to haunt you.
Sometimes I think it's a lot. It's very similar to keeping the animal going for your own sake. I think it must be easier. I'm not a parent, but it must be easier to not deal with that difficult decision than to really get down and dirty with your kids and say, look, life is hard and sometimes it's short and there are things we can do to make the lives of those we care about easier, and sometimes humane euthanasia is one of those things we can do for a pet. Mm-hmm. Because, man, that is not a conversation I would be looking forward to having with a kid.
Yeah.
But I can see its necessity.
It's difficult, but at some point, even I think even at an early, very early age, 3 or 4 years old, children have the capacity to understand, and they also have the capacity to grieve. And I think that, you know, kind of as a parent myself, I would want to kind of help guide my child through that process to help her deal with loss, because eventually, at some point later in her life, she is going to have to deal with loss, either the loss of a parent or grandparents.
Such a scary thing to go through that alone when
exactly.
you're that young and you don't quite understand it.
Exactly. And if you've never had to go through that process before, when something tragic and serious happens later in life, they may not have the skills to cope with it. And so really helping kids through this process at an early age can help to develop their empathy and help develop their sense of you know what happens after we're here on this earth.
The life cycle is
exactly.
being a whole natural thing. I think it's also important for people not to be scared of their or repressive of their own emotions or their children's emotions. I mean, you know, being half Sicilian, you go to a Sicilian funeral and people wail and scream and cry, and it's just part of the process, and then they're done. And there are other, you know, cultural attitudes toward grieving which involve keeping a stiff upper lip.
And cultural attitudes toward animals that say, where a person can say to themselves, should I really be getting this upset about a dog? Absolutely. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to be really, really sad. It's okay to be paralyzed with grief about the loss of a companion.
Whatever's actually true.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We're talking to Darren Llewellyn of Smith Veterinary Hospital. As of yesterday, yesterday was your last day at work.
That's right.
A very sad loss for us here in Santa Fe, and Bill Hutchison of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. We've got a few minutes left. I want to make sure to give you, Bill, a little time to talk about what's happening at the animal shelter.
Well, not a lot of grieving and sorrow there right now. We have lots and lots of healthy, healthy animals. We, like many shelters, we have a really active transfer program where we help a lot of the rural shelters around the state when they get really overcrowded. But this is the time of year where everybody is overcrowded, and especially with cats. We've gone kind of cat crazy, and I know throughout the state that every shelter in New Mexico is filled with cats right now. So if you have been thinking about bringing a cat into your home, wherever you are, if you are from Santa Fe, come to the Santa Fe Animal Shelter. If you're from out of town, go to your local animal shelter and help get some cats some homes, because there are a lot of them looking for them right now, and they could really use some help. You can always see all of our adoptable cats online at www.sfhumanesociety.org. It updates every hour, so you know exactly who's in there at any given moment.
Now, there are programs, if there are feral cats in your neighborhood, to catch, spay, neuter, and release the cats.
I believe Felines and Friends is pretty active in, they call it trap, neuter, release programs. And certainly there are a number of vets throughout the community that help take part in that. Animal control will also help you if you have feral cats, but if you're really interested in a TNR program, I would contact one of the excellent cat rescue groups in Santa Fe who can give you lots of information on what you can do. And certainly, you know, I guess I'd chime in with this as well. We say this a lot, but overpopulation is not a shelter problem, it's a community problem. If you have the resources to help in a trap, neuter, release situation, sometimes just calling a rescue group is not really helping all that much because they tend to be staffed by volunteers with incredibly limited resources. So if you can shell out a few bucks to help one of these organizations or to pay a veterinarian for some of the sterilization surgeries, that goes a long, long way. Sometimes helping means moving a little bit outside of our comfort zone, and certainly with the overpopulation issue, everybody has to step up.
I was talking to somebody yesterday who lives right near the place where there's some feral cats, and I said, you know, there are these programs, and he said, well, I don't like to interfere with nature.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I'll tell you straight up, I think that's a perverse way of thinking, because we have interfered with nature already by domesticating
them. Animals.
Exactly. And I heard somebody say the other day, there's no such thing as a feral cat. They've all belonged to somebody, and they can be brought back, and I personally don't believe that's the case. There are such things as feral cats. When we talk about feral, it does not mean they live in the forest, swing from trees, and you know their eyes glow in the dark from 6-inch-long claws. A feral animal is. We have lots of feral dogs and cats in the community, and this is not nature. They're living on the fringes of society. They are often suffering and dying horrible deaths at the hands of vehicles, not natural.
And starvation,
which for a domestic animal is not natural, or at the hands of cruel pranksters and kids, which is also not natural. So there's nothing natural about having cats and dogs really in the first place. So certainly I don't think there's anything. Interfere with nature. Interfere in that kind of situation.
Well,
Do your part to prevent some suffering.
The many ways in which we live in society are what's called civilized coming from cities, and we do all sorts of things like not grow our own food and have division of labor and have domesticated animals, and we have to make structures and rules around that. But it was interesting to me to hear somebody actually say that.
I can understand the impulse. I really, really can. And I think that there's a lot of things we can do to sort of leave nature alone, but when we're talking about a pocket of cats within a city, that's not nature by a long shot. Let's let the wolves do their thing. Let's let the eagles and all the birds and critters of the forest and the Llano do their thing. But when we're talking about in town, it's a long way from nature, a long way.
And to kind of chime in here too, feral animals actually are more destructive to natural processes than people realize, because these are animals that are not naturally, you don't see natural births of domesticated short-haired cats. This is not a wild animal. They are wild in the sense that a lot of times they can't be caught or held or really even be turned into a pet. You know, oftentimes if a kitten doesn't have human contact within the first 2 to 3 weeks of its life, they're going to be fearful of people, and they can be very dangerous. I can tell you I'd rather take on the biggest, meanest dog in the world than a feral cat, because they can tear you up.
And you're guaranteed an infection, really terrible infection.
Absolutely.
If it bites and claws you.
If it bites or claws you.
And really, the feral animal population really is kind of destroying local ecosystems, too, because there are killing off the natural wildlife that occurs in our area.
Meaning birds, or meaning what?
Meaning birds, meaning snakes.
There was a recent report, I don't remember from whom, about the number of endangered songbirds growing because of domesticated cat populations. Mm-hmm. Blew my mind. I really didn't realize what a serious issue it was.
Wow.
And we're not the only country that has this problem either. Australia has a terrible, terrible feral cat problem. And it really is bringing some of their natural species that can be only found in Australia near to the brink of extinction.
Between that and the cane toads of Queensland.
Yeah. And so, you know, the feral cat and feral dog issue is very serious. And of course, with these trap, neuter, release programs, we're not really removing those animals from the ecosystem. So they can still do damage, but at least we are keeping them from
growing
and keeping that population from growing.
We're coming to the end of our show, and we once again want to say that we are so sad that you are leaving, although we wish you the best of luck and happiness in your new life in Austin, Texas, Darren Llewellyn. And Bill and I have, between the two of us, composed a poem, nay, a limerick, for you. We will read it together.
I hope this limerick can be read on air.
You're about to find
most
out.
Most limericks I've heard don't.
If you have small children, you might want to put them in the closet for a moment.
The great veterinarian Darren could heal dog, cat, iguana, or heron.
He got a new job, that despicable slob.
Without him, our lives will be barren.
We are really going to miss Darren. Certainly, he's been a real voice for animals. And, you know, it gets very annoying walking around town and having people not say to me, hey, you're the guy here on the radio, but hearing people say, hey, you're the guy that's on the radio with that cool veterinarian. And now our cool veterinarian is not going to be on the radio, so we're going to miss him.
Thank you for your years of service to KSFR and to this community.
You guys have been wonderful. I've enjoyed being on the show for the last 3 years. It's been a great outlet for me to kind of speak my piece and get things on my mind out there and really kind of trying to stimulate conversation about animals. And I think that was the most important thing, is that we need to talk about these things. We need to realize what's going on and be better advocates for our pets. And I really think Mary Charlotte and Bill, you guys have really stepped up and helped helped our animal friends by getting the word out.
I really want to thank KSFR, too, for giving the animals of this community a voice as it has. It's been an incredibly supportive organization for the animals of this community.
Thank you so much, both of you, Darren Llewellyn and Bill Hutchison of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. And it's time to go. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. And we're podcasting. SantaFeRadioCafe.org is my website. You can listen to the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Brian Highhill, guest DJ, during the 10 o'clock hour, and Giants of Jazz wraps up the tribute to Duke Ellington with the New Orleans Suite and the 1969 White House Tribute. And tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic, Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. That's at 7 o'clock. You can show up at 7. There are tickets for you, or you can call in advance, 988-1234. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao. Thank you.